good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 679 of Unwelcome Guests, The New Pearl Harbor, Part 3. I'm Robin Upton, and you won't hear much more from me. This is going to be one of the shortest ever introductions, because I had to squeeze about 2 hours and 5 minutes of video into a 2-hour show. So I've trimmed some of the most visual parts. We continue where we left off last time. This is the third and final part of Massimo Mazzuccio's film, The New Pearl Harbor.
Reportedly, by the year 2000, the Port Authority was looking at an asbestos abatement bill of as much as $1 billion, the same money it would have cost to build a brand new tower. Back in the 90s, the Port Authority had sued the insurance companies, trying to get them to cover the cost of the asbestos removal. But in May 2001, 4 months before the terrorist attack, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey lost their 10-year-old court battle. At that point, the Port Authority was between a rock and a hard place. The Twin Towers could no longer be maintained without incurring the cost of asbestos removal, yet they could not be demolished because of the large amounts of asbestos they contained. The only remaining option was to dismantle and remove the two poison-filled giants one piece at a time. But the cost of such an operation would have been so astronomical that no one has ever tried to put a number on it. Luckily for all, the stalemate was broken when a real estate tycoon named Larry Silverstein, who already owned Building 7, offered to purchase a 99-year lease for the Twin Towers.
76 years old, and look at him go. He walks fast, talks fast, and is always, always selling.
Silverstein seemed in a big hurry to close the deal. Even though he had been hospitalized for a car accident during the bidding operations, he asked his doctors to take him off the morphine so the deal could be finalized.
So I told the doctor, I said, kill the morphine, and I got to get my people in here, because you can't think with morphine. So they let the morphine run down. The pain was terrible, but I brought everybody together, and that's when we framed our best and final bid.
On July 24th, 2001, Larry Silverstein celebrated the acquisition of the Twin Towers with a public ceremony.
Silverstein signed the lease on the World Trade Center just 6 weeks before 9/11.
He then took out an insurance policy covering the Twin Towers for $3.2 billion in case of total destruction. Silverstein then began spending every morning of the week in his new office in the North Tower.
And so my mornings were spent at the Trade Center, and then by noon I was back uptown.
But on September 11, luckily for him, Silverstein didn't go to work. Even though he had already scheduled a business meeting in the North Tower, he found out that his wife had made an appointment for him at the dermatologist.
The morning of September 11th, Silverstein was scheduled to have breakfast at the restaurant at the top of the North Tower. He canceled at the last minute at the insistence of his wife, Clara, who wanted him to go see his dermatologist.
That particular morning, my wife, God bless her, had made an appointment for me. At the doctor. I said, okay, yes, dear, I'll go.
Everyone who was in that restaurant that morning perished.
And then, just minutes later, received a telephone call that turned on a television set and witnessed this horrendous circumstance.
This is how, on the evening of September 11, Larry Silverstein found himself in control of some 12 million square feet of new office space to be built on some of the most valuable real estate in the world. And since the terrorist attacks had been two separate events, contended Silverstein, the insurance companies would have to pay him $7 billion to rebuild what he has always been calling my three towers.
I will spend $7 billion on my three towers.
Eventually, a settlement was reached for $4.5 billion, which was still one-third more than the amount initially insured by Silverstein. And since on September 11, due to the terrorist attacks, Building 7 had also been destroyed, Silverstein received another $800 million to rebuild a skyscraper that had originally cost $400 million.
It's a much more beautiful building. It's a glass facade, allows the light to come into the space. The views on four sides are phenomenal, and the space looks magnificent.
In the meantime, all the asbestos from the Twin Towers has been inhaled by the citizens of downtown Manhattan, and especially by the first responders and volunteers who worked at Ground Zero, who are now being decimated by mesothelioma and other pulmonary diseases.
NIST versus the architects and engineers.
In the debate over the destruction of the World Trade Center, two important organizations have played a major role. One is NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which was officially tasked by the U.S. government to investigate the collapse of the three skyscrapers. In 2005, NIST presented their final report on the collapse of the Twin Towers, and in 2008, the one on Building 7. For the Twin Towers, NIST concluded that they were brought down by the consequences of the impacts and the ensuing fires, while Building 7, according to NIST, was brought down primarily by fire alone. In other words, they fully confirmed the official version by the U.S. government. The other organization to bear weight on the debate has been Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, an association of professionals in civil construction founded in 2006 by San Francisco architect Richard Gage. Architects and Engineers lists over 2,000 experts in structural engineering, science of materials, architectural design, fire protection, science of construction, metallurgy, and even experts in controlled demolitions. Since they've entered the fray, Architects and Engineers has brought to the table a solid amount of scientific information refuting the official explanation by NIST on the collapses and confirming the theory of controlled demolitions instead. At the same time, Architects and Engineers has acted as an unrelenting watchdog for every action taken by NIST, pointing out every single error in their work and even forcing them, in some cases, to make corrections to their reports.
I think it's something that we need to clarify and correct in the final version of the report.
The first issue that needs to be clarified is the actual strength and solidity of the Twin Towers, since both the 9/11 Commission and the debunkers have made extensive efforts to depict them as extremely light and fragile buildings.
John Farmer of the 9/11 Commission.
The outside of each tower was covered by a frame of 14-inch wide steel columns. The centers of the steel columns were 40 inches apart. These exterior walls bore the majority of the weight of the building. The interior core of the buildings was a hollow steel shaft in which elevators and stairwells were grouped.
Alberto Angela, debunker. The towers in New York were supported by an external frame, by thin steel nerves. They were like empty parallel pipeds. Paolo Attivissimo says, the World Trade Center was an extremely light structure. It was the highest expression of the light skyscraper, as experts call it. As far as I know, there's only one other building, the former Sears Tower in Chicago, which uses the same kind of structure. After the World Trade Center complex, no one used it anymore.
As we shall see, all these statements are false. Contrary to traditional skyscrapers, where all the support columns are equally spaced, in the Twin Towers, part of the supporting columns had been moved towards the exterior wall, creating a large column-free space available for rental. For this reason, the external structure had literally become a grid of steel columns made with prefabricated blocks that were mounted on site. These are the thin steel nerves mentioned by debunker Alberto Angela, 244 steel columns placed approximately 2 feet apart, which supported 40% of the weight of the towers. Far from being two empty parallelepipeds, the internal structure was comprised of 47 steel columns, so long and sturdy that a special factory in Japan had to be built in order to assemble them. It was the core structure to support the majority of the weight of the building, 60% of it, and not the external structure. The core structure, seen on the left, is what the 9/11 Commission has called a hollow steel shaft. This is the same core structure near the base of the tower. The core structure was an actual, extremely robust steel skyscraper built within another skyscraper. The core structure housed the stairs, the elevators, and all other services needed for the functioning of the tower. The inner walls of the core structure were made of simple layers of sheetrock. A long series of steel trusses connected the core structure to the external one and supported the floors. The floors were also prefabricated rectangular pieces covered by a thin layer of concrete. The internal and external structure connected through an umbrella-like structure called a hat truss, which kept together the towers and bound them from above. The idea that this kind of structure is fragile and therefore no longer used after 9/11 is disproven by the new Building 7 built by Larry Silverstein. A strong central structure supports the majority of the weight of the building. Long steel beams support the floors and connect the core structure to the external one, allowing for a large column-free space in between. A very similar concept to the one used in the Twin Towers. Most importantly, the debunkers forget to mention that the Twin Towers were built with a structural redundancy of 3 to 5 times the weight they were meant to support.
Anthony Sambotti, mechanical engineer from Architects and Engineers.
These buildings are built to handle several times the load above them. So those perimeter columns could handle five times the load above them, and the core columns could handle three times the load above them.
In addressing the solidity of the Twin Towers, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology stated that its 244 perimeter columns made it one of the most redundant and one of the most resilient skyscrapers. On the same subject, the architectural firm of Roth & Sons wrote, "The building, as designed, is 16 times stiffer than a conventional structure. The Virendeel trusses would be so effective, according to the engineer's calculations, that all the columns on one side of a tower could be cut, as well as the two corners and several columns on the adjacent sides, and the tower would still be strong enough to withstand 100-mile-per-hour wind." John Skilling, the structural engineer who designed the Twin Towers, stated, "Live loads on these perimeter columns can be increased more than 2,000% before failure occurs." In particular, the Twin Towers were designed to sustain the impact of a large airliner traveling at 600 miles per hour and still remain standing. Interviewed in 1993 by the Seattle Times, John Skilling stated, "We looked at every possible thing we could think of that could happen to the buildings, even to the extent of an airplane hitting the side. Our analysis indicated the biggest problem would be the fact that all the fuel from the airplane would dump into the building. There would be a horrendous fire. A lot of people would be killed. The building structure would still be there." And it was. After the impacts, both towers remained standing, showing no major effect on their stability. Furthermore, NIST has confirmed that the initial jet fuel fires themselves lasted at most a few minutes. This means that from that moment on, the only available source of fuel for the fires was common office furnishings. And, as we know, regular office fires are not hot enough to affect the stability of a steel structure.
Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
No steel frame high-rise building has ever collapsed due to fire.
Professor John Barnett, fire protection engineer.
In over 20 years, I have not seen, until recently, a protected steel structure that has collapsed in a fire.
David Childs, high-rise architect.
These kinds of designs have performed extraordinarily well over history. In fact, until this occurrence, no building had fallen down because of fire.
Furthermore, NIST estimated the combustible fuel loading was somewhat lower than found in prior surveys of office spaces. The number of interior walls, and thus the minimal amount of combustible interior finish, and limited bookshelf space account for much of the differences. There was no reason for the towers to collapse at that point. With a structure that had clearly withstood the impacts and with less than average office content to feed the fires, both buildings should have remained standing, allowing for the evacuation and rescue of everyone who had survived the initial impacts and the fires. Instead, both buildings suddenly collapsed from top to bottom, one 56 minutes after the impact, the other as much as 1 hour and 42 minutes after the impact of the plane. Why? The debate on the collapse of the Twin Towers centers around two major questions. One is what caused the initial collapse of the top section of the building onto the lower part of each tower. The second is what caused the complete destruction of the remaining healthy structure below once the top section had collapsed on it. As far as what initiated the collapse, at first we were told that the heat of the fires had softened and melted the structure of the building.
In 2002, NOVA depicted a scenario envisioned by many experts at the time, that the truss connections failed in the extreme heat, causing the floors to fall onto one another, precipitating the collapse.
As the steel began to soften and melt, the interior core columns began to give. Then you had this sequential failure that took place where it all pancaked one after the other.
In fact, it became known as the pancake theory.
This is Jérôme Quirot. As one piece falls on the floor, the floor gives in. After that, each floor cascaded and fell on top of the others. This is what we call the pancake theory.
But the pancake theory had a major flaw. It forgot to explain why the core structure of the towers collapsed. Furthermore, experts pointed out that jet fuel produces barely half the heat needed to melt steel. It would not have been enough to disconnect the trusses from the external structure. At that point, the official explanation backtracked and settled for a more generic weakening of the steel due to the fires.
James Coburn, Popular Mechanics.
You don't need to melt the steel columns, you just need to start weakening them.
This is Jim Miggs again on a program called 9/11 Myth Buster.
what we found is it doesn't take temperatures high enough to melt steel. It just has to heat up the steel so it expands and then softens and weakens the structure until it collapses.
In the new explanation, the initial failure was no longer blamed on the rupture of the steel trusses, but on their sagging due to the heat.
The trusses stayed connected to the columns even as they sagged from the heat. They pulled on the columns, bowing them inward nearly 5 feet in some areas, until the columns reached the breaking point.
Shyam Sunder, lead NIST investigator.
Suddenly the columns snapped, and as a result the entire top of the building came down pretty much in free fall because the kinetic energy that was unleashed was just huge.
NIST also maintained that the impact of the airplanes widely dislodged the fireproofing from the trusses, hastening the process that eventually caused them to sag. It should be noted that NIST made the dislodgement of the fireproofing a necessary condition for the towers to collapse.
The buildings would not have collapsed under the effects of the airplane impact and the jet fuel ignited multi-floor fires. And the reason it collapsed is because the fireproofing was dislodged.
But the theory of the sagging trusses created even more problems than the one before. First of all, there is no proof whatsoever that the fireproofing from the steel had been widely dislodged by the impacts, as NIST has maintained. The steel structure of a skyscraper is elastic, not rigid, and it absorbs the impacts by slowly swaying back and forth, not by vibrating.
The building swayed slowly one way toward the Hudson River to the west.
And by the time it came back, I just jumped up and just had to get out of the elevator.
In fact, there are good reasons to believe that the fireproofing from the steel was not dislodged at all, as in the following example.
This is James Glanz for the New York Times. When the plane hit the North Tower between the 94th and the 98th floors, Steve McIntyre, an engineer for the American Bureau of Shipping, was reading his email on the 91st floor. The plane hit, and I think he described it as the biggest wham he'd ever heard. But there wasn't much shaking. His email was still there after the impact. He was still staring at a glowing screen. He had a little knick-knack, a piece of slate in the shape of a sailboat, hadn't fallen off his desk. Pictures of his wife and kids just propped up on a bookcase were still upright. Nothing had fallen over.
McIntyre was just below the point of impact. If his pictures didn't even fall, why should the spray-on fireproofing have been detached from the steel trusses? Secondly, there's no proof that the temperatures were high enough to seriously weaken the steel in any case, with or without fireproofing.
Leslie Young, high-rise architect.
The majority of the jet fuel was burnt up instantly in the big fireball, and it was gone. The fires that were left were office furnishings and carpet and things like that. A lot of things in these kind of buildings have to be fire-resistant by nature. It's required by code.
In their computer simulation, NIST claims to have observed temperatures beyond 1,800 degrees during the fires. But NIST has used their own computational model, and they've never published the data from their simulation. When architects and engineers asked to verify the computer model used by NIST, their request was denied. The truth is that NIST itself admitted, in their own report, to have no proof for temperatures high enough to seriously weaken steel. From the NIST report, we read, of the more than 170 areas examined on 16 perimeter column panels, only 3 columns had evidence that the steel reached temperatures above 250 degrees centigrade, or 480 degrees Fahrenheit. Only 2 core column specimens had sufficient paint remaining to make such an analysis, and the temperatures did not reach 250 degrees centigrade. No conclusive evidence was found to indicate that pre-collapse fires were severe enough to have a significant effect on the microstructure that would have resulted in weakening of the steel structure. In other words, NIST openly admits to have no proof to support their own theory. In conclusion, the known facts are: steel melts at about 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. Softening can begin at about 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit. Except for 3 isolated spots, NIST admits to have found no proof of temperatures beyond 480 degrees Fahrenheit, which is less than half the temperatures needed to seriously weaken steel. On the other hand, there is multiple evidence that the temperatures needed to seriously weaken steel were not reached for a sustained time in the Twin Towers. The first one is that a group of 16 people managed to descend through the area devastated by the impact without obviously being burned alive. One of them is Brian Clark.
And when we came to the 78th floor, the last layer was standing, but it was cracked. And there were flames licking up the other side of the wall like this. It wasn't a roaring inferno. I sensed that the flames were maybe starved for oxygen right there, you know, in the interior. We kept going, and we got onto the 74th floor when we got down that far. Normal conditions. The lights were on, fresh air coming up from below.
Attivissimo has maintained that these people managed to survive because in that part of the building, the stairwell runs on the side of the tower and not through the center.
When they went through there, they went across an area that was on the opposite side from the fires. Obviously, they didn't get burned. The stairwell crosses over here and descends.
In truth, stairwell A traverses to the side of the tower on the 82nd floor, but Clark and his colleagues were on the 84th. This means they descended two floors in the center of the tower before crossing over. Furthermore, one of Clark's colleagues went back from the 81st to the 91st floor before descending all the way to the ground.
Brian Clark, South Tower survivor.
Ron DeFrancesco, who went in the 81st floor with me. He went up to 91, caught up to the people, laying down on the floor, to thinking that there was fresher air at floor level. He made his way back to the stairs.
Ron DeFrancesco, South Tower survivor.
And so I started to run downstairs, and so I ended up on the ground level, and I went to walk out.
Had there been a temperature of 1,100 degrees around the stairwell, nobody would have been able to go through it alive. Secondly, there is a series of thermographic images shot with an infrared camera showing temperatures much lower than those needed to soften steel. This is the North Tower, seen from below. It's 9:18, about a half an hour after the impact of the first plane, and the indicated temperatures do not reach the color yellow, which means they don't exceed 100 degrees centigrade or 212 degrees Fahrenheit. And this is the South Tower, some 15 minutes after the impact of the second plane. Here, too, the indicated temperatures do not exceed 212 degrees Fahrenheit. But the major problem with the sagging trusses theory is that it doesn't make any sense from a mechanical point of view. Even assuming the temperatures were high enough to make them sag to such an extent, where did these relatively thin trusses find the strength to pull and then break apart a supporting structure much larger and stronger than they were? The phenomenon suggested by NIST is called thermal expansion. If one assumes that the trusses were forced to expand downwards by the vertical structures resisting the push, it means they were weaker than the structure and they would have never found the strength to pull it inwards. If instead the trusses sagged on their own, so weakened by fire to become unable to support their own weight, where would they find the strength to pull and break apart the same structure that had easily supported them when they were strong and healthy? In either case, the idea that the trusses alone would have been able to pull and break apart the external structure makes no sense. As we shall see, the external structure did bow inwards before the towers collapsed. But a much greater force than their own must have been applied to those trusses for them to be able to pull and break apart the structure they were attached to. Question: can you provide any evidence that the fireproofing from the steel trusses was widely dislodged by the impact of the planes, which NIST has made a necessary condition for the collapses to be caused by fire? Can you provide any evidence that the temperatures in the Twin Towers were high enough and lasted long enough to seriously weaken the steel in the areas where the initial collapses occurred? Can you explain how a sagging truss weakened by heat could pull and eventually break apart the structure it is attached to, with no external force being applied to it? If the explanation by NIST on what caused the initial collapse seems seriously flawed, their explanation on what caused the complete destruction of the towers does not exist. Within more than 10,000 pages filled with technical data of relative importance, in a footnote on page 82 of the NIST report, we read, "The focus of the investigation was on the sequence of events from the instant of aircraft impact to the initiation of collapse for each tower. For brevity of this report, the sequence is referred to as the probable collapse sequence, although it does not actually include the structural behavior of the tower after the conditions for collapse initiation were reached and collapse became inevitable." With the simple word inevitable, NIST purports to have explained the total destruction of 80,000 tons of a perfectly healthy steel structure upon itself.
William Rice, civil engineer.
The area below the damage zone where the planes flew in and where the fire was, that area below that, those 80 or 90 stories, 80,000 tons of structural steel was not damaged in any way. Yet you stood there and watched it destroy itself wiping out floor by floor all 287 structural columns as if they didn't exist underneath the damage zone.
When a well-known debunking website wrote to NIST asking for a clarification on the sequence of the collapses, it received a similar answer. NIST did not describe the specific sequence of events after global collapse initiated. This astonishing statement has been repeated by NIST over and over again under the most surprising of justifications.
John Gross, NIST lead engineer.
Once the collapse initiated, the video evidence is rather clear. It was not stopped by the floors below, so there was no calculation that we did to demonstrate that, so what is clear from the videos.
This is tantamount to saying, once the Pearl Harbor attack initiated, the video evidence shows that the U.S. fleet was quickly overwhelmed by the Japanese, so we didn't feel the need to find out why it happened. To make up for this embarrassing void, the debunkers often point at some independent studies which purport to explain the collapses by gravity alone.
There are technical studies, as the ones listed here, which analyze the dynamics of the collapse of the Twin Towers in utmost detail and find nothing wrong with them.
The study most quoted by debunkers is called What Did and Did Not Cause Collapse of the WTC Twin Towers in New York by Czech engineer Zdeněk Bazant. But in his own study, Mr. Bazant admits to have worked on a one-dimensional model, while he states, the high tilt seen on the South Tower top would call for a three-dimensional model of progressive collapse. In any case, it is not up to private studies to explain the collapse of the Twin Towers. NIST received $20 million of taxpayers' money to determine why and how World Trade Center 1 and World Trade Center 2 collapsed following the initial impacts of the aircraft, and to this day, they have not done so. This is why Architects and Engineers has kept pressing NIST, asking them to publish their data in regards to the potential energy released during the downwards movement of the upper stories and the absorptive capacity of the intact structure below the collapsed zone.
Richard Gage, founder of AE 911 Truth.
Structural engineers do this every day. This is not rocket science. You have the known weight of this building mass. You have what are known columns below it in order to resist it. You let it go in your models, and you calculate what the resistance is. Why didn't they do it? Could it be because they knew darn well that it would not have collapsed at all?
In fact, it could be suggested that NIST never explained the collapses by gravity alone, because it would be impossible to do so without violating at least two of the most fundamental laws of physics. One is Newton's third law of motion, which states that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. This means that two opposing forces will neutralize each other. In a head-on collision, the two cars absorb each other's kinetic energy and transform it into physical deformation or damage. After that, the system comes to a rest, as there is no more energy to be dissipated.
David Chandler from Architects and Engineers.
The top section, pushing on the bottom section, it's going to meet equal forces as it goes. Both sections are going to be demolished at the same rate. So by the time you've crushed up 15 stories below it, the top 15 stories are also going to be crushed. And so there's nothing left now to crush the rest of the building.
Something of this kind is what we should have seen when the top section of the towers collapsed onto the lower one. The upper and lower sections should have mutually destroyed each other until all the energy is dissipated and the system comes to a rest. Alternatively, as shown in this experiment with two towers made of snow, the top section could have fallen off to the side after the initial collapse. What could not have happened is this.
A little tiny chunk of the building can't possibly fall and crush the entire structure below it.
This is such a simple, fundamental concept that architects and engineers were astonished in seeing it totally ignored by NIST.
Richard Engel, civil engineer.
This is high school physics, and our whole society is being led to believe that these fundamental laws of physics, hard science, don't apply anymore.
But even if we assume that the top section of the tower had enough potential energy to destroy the rest of the structure below, it could not have done so at the speed it did, which was near freefall speed. That would have violated an even more important principle in physics, known as the law of momentum conservation. This law states that the total energy within an isolated system must always remain the same. As we have seen, the energy can be transformed within the system, from motion to physical deformation. But for the deformation to begin, the velocity must decrease, in order for one kind of energy to be transformed into the other. No new energy can be added to the system. One particular example of momentum conservation is free fall. Free fall happens when the only force applied on an object is gravity. This means that all the potential energy contained by the object is converted into vertical motion. As soon as the falling object hits an obstacle and breakage occurs, the speed must decrease because some of its energy needs now to be converted into physical breakage. It takes energy to break things apart, and that energy must come from within the system. Thus, the falling rock cannot keep falling at free fall speed and break apart at the same time because it doesn't have enough energy to do both. Let's go now to the Twin Towers and ask a simple question.
There's a diagram of the thought experiment. On the left is a twin tower in its usual position. On the right, there's the top section of a twin tower being suspended by a crane in midair.
Assuming that the top section on the left contains enough potential energy to destroy the rest of the tower, and assuming we dropped both upper sections at the same time, which one would hit the ground first? It would be the second, of course. As it finds no obstacles in its path, the section on the right would quickly accelerate to free fall speed and maintain it all the way to the ground. The section on the left, instead, needs to use some of its energy to destroy the structure below, so it could never achieve free fall speed. In the case of the Twin Towers, however, both upper sections fell with an acceleration close to free fall speed, as if their path had been practically free from obstacles. It took each tower between 10 and 12 seconds to collapse to the ground, while an absolute free fall time would have been 9.2 seconds. In other words, both upper sections of the towers found enough energy to destroy 80,000 tons of healthy structure below, while accelerating to near free fall speed. This is, as we have said, absolutely impossible by gravity alone. The law of momentum conservation won't allow it.
Jonathan Smolens, structural engineer from Architects and Engineers.
A building cannot do free fall with a huge steel structural system in place to support it.
Alfred Lopez, structural engineer from Architects and Engineers.
The Twin Towers could not have come straight down through the resistance of 80,000 tons of structural steel at the speed of practically free fall. That just would not happen.
If in fact it actually hit and made an impact, it was effectively crushing anything, pushing hard on this core structure below it. The core structure is going to push back equally hard, and that's what's going to cause the top section of the building to slow down.
As energy is drained away from the system to deform those members, it would slow down the descending mass and cause a descent at less than free fall speed.
There is only one way for those buildings to have collapsed at the speed they did.
The buildings fall at a speed which can only occur if the structure has been removed, the vertical structure.
The same Shyam Sunder from NIST has acknowledged that free fall can only be achieved with the absence of a structure below.
Free fall time would be an object that has no structural components below it.
But what could have removed the supporting structure below, since the falling section didn't have any extra energy to do so?
The fact that it's coming down at free fall says all of the energy is being used to just make it go straight down, which means it's coming down through itself and not breaking up the building as it goes. Something else has to be clearing the way.
There is only one known way to allow that kind of acceleration while removing the supporting structure.
A building cannot do free fall without it being blown up. That's the only way it could come down at free fall.
The only way that a building can accelerate as it collapses is by having pre-engineered, precisely timed, and precisely placed explosives. In other words, controlled demolition.
Since a near freefall speed automatically means a controlled demolition, the debunkers have tried to deny that the Twin Towers fell in about 10 seconds each.
Collapse time. We talk about 10 seconds of freefall time, and that's correct. But the collapse times for the Twin Towers are not those of freefall. Based on the available videos, they last at least 16 seconds. All you need to do is to listen to how long the rumble lasts. And now he's playing the audience a video not of the collapse of one of the towers from the outside, but a rather confusing video taken from inside another building. So the aim is to just listen to the noise. If you counted with me, it's a bit more than 10 seconds.
We couldn't count with him, as it's very difficult to establish the exact duration of a collapse by listening to the sounds only. Furthermore, a couple of seconds more or less would not make a big difference, as the time for the transfer of momentum between each collapsing floor must be considered anyway.
So a floor impacting on a floor below would transfer momentum. And those floors would transfer momentum such that into Twin Towers, if you didn't have any columns whatsoever, it would still take a minimum of 30 seconds for these towers to collapse, just by transferring the momentum of the floors.
In any case, the near free fall speed of about 10 seconds has been confirmed by different official sources. The 9/11 Commission wrote that the South Tower collapsed in 10 seconds. Mr. Sunder from NIST has confirmed similar timings.
The measurements have indicated that Tower 1 collapsed in about 11 seconds and Tower 2 collapsed in about 9 seconds.
Mr. Sunder has also acknowledged that the towers came down practically at free fall speed.
As a result, the entire top of the building came down pretty much in free fall.
The same admission is present in the official report. Since the stories below the level of collapse initiation provided little resistance, the building section above came down essentially in free fall. At this point, we can pose the following question. Given that the building section above came down essentially in free fall, given that for free fall to occur, no supporting structure must be present, and given that the falling sections didn't have any extra energy to destroy the structure below, can you suggest anything different from some kind of controlled demolition for the removal of the supporting structure, which was necessary for near free fall speed to be achieved? At this point, one may wonder what the response by the debunkers has been to all the scientific arguments presented by architects and engineers. There has been no response. All the debunkers have done is to either belittle this association of professionals or to ignore it altogether.
Jérôme Quiron says, in regards to the engineers who signed the declaration, it's a nightmare. You have electrical engineers, engineers in hydraulics, engineers in nuclear safety. It's the Tower of Babel of engineering. Those who are competent in structural design, I've checked them out. They are 30 at most, and that's being generous.
Whether the experts in structural engineering are 30 or 300, it should not make any difference. It's their arguments that must be refuted, and Quirant has never done so. Attivissimo, instead, has chosen to belittle architects and engineers as a whole by terming all its members as gymnasium builders.
We have only Richard Gage and his 1,200 gymnasium builders who say, well, we believe that.
But Attivissimo has never responded to their arguments either. But the most shocking statement comes from Popular Mechanics. In their book, Debunking 9/11 Myths, they wrote, not one of the leading conspiracy theorists has a background in engineering, construction, or related fields. This statement appears both in the original publication, dated 2006, and in the revised edition, published in 2011. By then, architects and engineers had been active for almost 5 years, listed more than 1,300 experts in civil engineering, had made presentations in 20 different countries in the world, and had been invited on national television several times.
And what caught my eye is their claim that more than 1,300 architects and engineers examined the evidence about Building 7's collapse and disagree with the official report issued by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I certainly am much more open-minded about it than I was, and it is because of the involvement of the 9/11 families and all these engineers and architects. Clearly, they know more than I do.
The truth is that from the moment architects and engineers has entered the fray, not one of their scientific arguments disproving the official version and confirming the theory of controlled demolitions has been refuted in any way by the debunkers or by anyone else.
Part 6. The Twin Towers, the Hypothesis of Controlled Demolitions.
Let's now return to the previous question, which is still unanswered. What caused the initial collapse of the upper section of the towers under the rest of the building? As we have seen, there was a bowing of the facade before the collapse, but the trusses didn't have any strength of their own to cause such a massive bending of the external structure. If explosives were used, however, and this part of the core structure was made to collapse first, then the trusses would have had enough strength to pull along the facade and to initiate the global collapse. In fact, it was observed that the antenna from the North Tower begins dropping slightly before the top section of the building collapses, which indicates the central structure was destroyed first. Even though a controlled demolition seems the only valid explanation for the collapses, The debunkers have brought different arguments against this possibility. The first argument is that it would have been impossible to place the explosives under everyone's eyes.
It would take an army of workers. It would take months. So this idea that, you know, some crew dressed in black could sneak in the middle of the night and wire a building like that to be demolished is just, it's absurd.
There are, however, different facts to be considered. The first one is that in the months previous to 9/11, a major renovation of the elevator system in both towers was undertaken. From the March 2001 issue of Elevator World, we read, Ace Elevator undertook what was perhaps one of the largest, most sophisticated elevator modernization programs in the industry's history at New York City's prestigious World Trade Center. No one is suggesting that this company had anything to do with the possible planting of explosives, but such an extensive renovation process would have certainly provided the cover for a special team to access the internal structure of the buildings at any given time. As explained by Richard Heumann, chief electrical engineer for the Twin Towers, the elevator shafts gave direct access to the core columns.
I'm very familiar with the interior structure that surrounded the elevator shafts and, their access to the elevator shafts gave them total access to the surrounding core columns, the interior of the core columns.
Secondly, the movement of heavy equipment on floors that were supposedly empty was noticed in the weeks leading up to 9/11. Scott Forbes worked for a financial institution on the 97th floor of the South Tower.
It must have been at least 4 to 6 weeks before 9/11. It was like rebuilding work going on upstairs. The tenants, the people from Aon who had been removed somewhere else, the offices were just vacant. And there was a lot of heavy machinery building work going on. It was almost like pneumatic drills and lots of hammering, so much so that the floors were shaking. That's how noticeable it was. It was almost as if something heavy was being moved and then it was being taken off wheels and it was like boom. Our floor underneath literally shook. You could feel the weight above you.
William Rodriguez, an employee at the Twin Towers for more than 20 years, recalls a similar experience.
As I stood there on the 33rd floor, I heard very strange noises on the 34th floor. I heard very heavy equipment being moved around, and it sounded like dumpsters with metal wheels being moved around, and I got scared because I knew it was an empty floor. Nobody was supposed to be there. As a matter of fact, not even the elevators stopped there. You have to have a special access key to open the door on the 34th floor.
Thirdly, after the 1993 attack, bomb-sniffing dogs had been adopted in the security system of the Twin Towers. But on Thursday, September the 6th, bomb-sniffing dogs were abruptly removed, according to a security guard, with no apparent reason. And lastly, there was an unprecedented power down in the South Tower on the very weekend before 9/11. For the first time in 30 years, all the security systems in the building had become useless at the same time. People could come and go as they pleased, even in protected areas, without being seen or recorded by surveillance cameras.
Gary Corbett, former employee of a bank in World Trade Center 2.
The previous weekend, there had been a power down. Because of the power down, there was a complete breakdown of security that weekend. We had guided tours coming into secured areas by mistake and nobody picking it up because there's no intrusion alarms or anything else.
Scott Forbes was also present during the power down.
There was a power down in the South Tower on the weekend of the 8th and 9th of September. And it wouldn't have just have affected camera security. It would have affected all the secure systems on doors for either key locks or security badges and so on to undo them. They weren't working because they're all powered by electricity, so there was no power, there was no backup system, therefore they were all open.
What again was the excuse that the Port Authority gave you, Scott, for this 36-hour period of the power being down in the South Tower?
The explanation was that there was a recabling exercise to increase the bandwidth of networks that were available in the towers. But what I can recall is that there were plenty of toolboxes, there were plenty of spools of cable, there were men around wearing overalls, they appeared to be like engineers. At the time, it seemed perfectly legitimate what they were doing because this was the story we were given, that there was a recabling exercise.
The debunkers are right. it would have been very difficult to bring in the explosives without being noticed. But with the proper cover story, it could have been done under everyone's eyes, in full daylight, without anybody even questioning what was going on. Another argument by the debunkers is that controlled demolitions, they say, always begin from the bottom, while the destruction of the Twin Towers clearly started from the top.
David Coburn, Popular Mechanics.
If you look at the World Trade Centers, both of them began at the impact wounds where the planes hit. Controlled demolitions always begin from the bottom of the building. You cut the bottom columns and then the building falls.
But this is not true.
And these are controlled demolitions which are not starting from the bottom.
Every controlled demolition can be designed according to the needs. In fact, sometimes it's not a good idea to start from the bottom.
And this blows out the bottom floor, and the rest of the building just falls down a few floors and stops ponderously.
This brings us directly to the issue of explosions. In the same interview where he praised the solidity of the Twin Towers, John Skilling stated, "I'm not saying that properly applied explosives, shaped explosives of that magnitude, could not do a tremendous amount of damage. I would imagine that if you took the top expert in that type of work and gave him the assignment of bringing these buildings down with explosives, I would bet that he could do it." On September 11, there were dozens and dozens of loud explosions reported by firefighters, policemen, journalists, and regular citizens, both before and during the collapse of both towers. For all these explosions, however, the debunkers have a blanket explanation. The witnesses were confused. They were not real explosions.
It's interesting to notice that all the witnesses who've mentioned explosions, they've heard them, but no one has ever seen them. Gene Corley, debunker from FEMA.
There are things that happened inside the building, pieces coming loose as a result of the extreme impact, very well may have been interpreted as explosion.
Often the layperson talks about explosions. They don't specifically mean the dynamite charge going boom. They talk about a bang, a rumble, and a rumble can be caused by many things. Mark Loiseau, debunker from Controlled Demolitions, Inc.
What's an explosion sound like? Most people don't know because most people have never heard one. So any sharp, loud bang, that's probably an explosion.
The fact is, most of the explosions were reported by firefighters and policemen, and no one knows how to recognize an explosion in a burning building better than they do.
As we were getting our gear on and making our way to the stairway, there was a heavy-duty explosion, and everybody just started running for the door. Everybody was trapped.
New York's bravest never had a chance.
We really never even got that close to the building. An explosion blew and it knocked everybody over.
Greg Bartmer, former NYPD, first responder and ground zero worker.
The whole time you're hearing thoom, 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 thoom. So I think I know an explosion when I hear it.
In August 2005, the New York Times published 12,000 pages of oral histories rendered in the voices of 503 firefighters and emergency personnel who were present at the Trade Center on September 11. Over 100 of them, one-fifth of the total, has reported explosions in the buildings prior or during the collapses. Regular citizens also seem quite capable of telling an explosion from a simple object falling to the ground.
Something, either they blew the lobby up or something, because it blew the glass out of the doors and knocked us all down, and I got smoke and everything on me. I just feel a little shook up because I got blasted, so.
Before proceeding, one thing should be known about controlled demolitions. Just like the Twin Towers, most modern buildings are built with a high redundancy factor in terms of structural strength. For this reason, a series of preliminary explosions is normally needed in controlled demolitions to weaken the structure before the actual collapse can be induced. Obviously, in the case of the Twin Towers, it would not have been possible to set off the preliminary explosions all at once, just before the collapse. To make them less noticeable, it would have been wise to set them off at separate intervals, any time between the impacts of the planes and the collapse of the towers. For this reason, it's important to keep in mind the exact chronology of the events. 8:46, first impact into the North Tower. 9:03, second impact into the South Tower. 9:59, collapse of the South Tower. 10:28, collapse of the North Tower. 5:20 in the afternoon, collapse of Building 7. Witnesses normally call first explosion the one that came with the impact of the planes, while they call secondary explosions all those that took place in separate moments between the impacts of the planes and the collapse of the two towers.
We got that second, that first secondary explosion really got us spooked because we were in the building.
Then there was those secondary explosions and then the subsequent collapses.
We've heard reports of secondary explosions after the aircraft impacted.
According to several witnesses, there was a secondary explosion that took place in the basement of the North Tower just before the plane hit the building.
At 8:30, he says he was headed to level B4 in Tower 1, four stories below ground.
Philip Morelli, World Trade Center maintenance worker.
I go downstairs, the foreman tells me to go to remove the containers. As I'm walking by the main freight car of the building in the corridor, that's when I got blown. I mean, the impact of the explosion, of whatever happened, it threw me to the floor.
Morelli then remembers a second explosion, separate from the first.
I was racing, I was going towards a bathroom. All of a sudden, I opened the door, I didn't know it was a bathroom, and all of a sudden, a big impact happened again. And all the ceiling tile was falling down, the light fixtures were falling.
According to the 9/11 Commission, it was the jet fuel pouring down the elevator shafts that caused the explosion in the basement. From the final report we read, a jet fuel fireball erupted upon impact and shot down at least one bank of elevators. The fireball exploded onto numerous lower floors, including the B4 level, four stories below the ground. But the witnesses described an explosion that took place in the basement before the impact of the plane.
William Rodriguez, janitor of the North World Trade Center.
Very strong. Boom! An explosion so hard that pushed us upwards. Upwards. And it came from the basement between the B2 level and the B3 level. And at that moment, I thought it was the mechanical room where they have all the pumps and the generators for the building, that maybe a generator just blew up on the basement. Now, 20 years in the building, you know something that comes from the bottom and something that comes from the top. And when I went to verbalize that it was a generator, we hear, boom, all the way on the top, the impact of the plane on the top. Two different events, two different times.
There are others who remember several explosions after the one from below.
It came from, I believe, at first we believed that it came from the mechanical room. Then we heard a series of other explosions that sounded up on the above levels of the building.
I was in the B4 level, and on my way, I heard a bomb. So I says, probably a transformer again blew up. So I stepped back, finished what I had to finish, and I started towards the door again. And there come a big blast with a big ball of fire.
The two separate explosions were recorded at a distance of about 9 seconds from each other during a business meeting that was taking place in a building nearby, One Liberty Plaza.
What the heck was that?
It was the Encore.
When faced with this precise question, the editors of Popular Mechanics chose not to answer it and fell back on the generic explanation of the jet fuel in the elevator shafts.
Ask what your guys' explanation is for Willie Rodriguez's testimony that he experienced and his coworkers were actually burned by an explosion in the basement of the North Tower prior to the plane hitting. And this has been verified by at least 20 different eyewitnesses.
Jim Max of Popular Mechanics.
When the plane struck the buildings, they penetrated the internal core. Jet fuel poured down stairwells and elevator shafts, setting off secondary explosions, not to mention the horrific impact of these fully loaded planes hitting the structure and
Mr.
causing
Mix.
An enormous swain.
It's interesting to note, too, that you still didn't address the fact that it was before. Empire State Building crash back in 1945.
But the explanation of the jet fuel in the elevator shafts has several problems of its own. First of all, there were no regular elevators connecting the basement to the top levels of the towers. Each tower consisted of three separate buildings, built on top of one another, each with their own elevator system. There were only two elevators connecting the lobby to the 44th and 78th floor. But the plane struck on the 95th floor, which means the fuel could not have poured down these elevator shafts. There were only two banks of elevators that went all the way from the basement to the top of the towers, and they were mostly used by maintenance people. In one of these elevators was Arturo Griffith.
Well, I was on my way from B2 to 49th floor.
Not only didn't Griffith get cremated by this supposed ball of fire, but he also remembers three separate explosions.
And there was a loud explosion and the elevator dropped. When the elevator finally stopped, they had an explosion that bring the doors inside the elevator. And then they had another explosion on the panel that threw me you know, against the wall.
Most importantly, the theory of the jet fuel in the elevator shafts fails to take into consideration the volumes involved. Each tower had an approximate volume of 2,160,000 cubic yards. The planes that hit the towers carried an estimated 10,000 gallons of fuel each at the time of impact. 10,000 gallons is the equivalent of 50 cubic yards. This in-scale graphic shows what 50 cubic yards look like next to the volume of the tower. Assuming that about half of the fuel was consumed in the initial explosion, we would be left with some 25 cubic yards of fuel available. But most of this fuel is needed to ignite the fires at different floors, as explained by Mr. Meggs himself.
Jets crashed into buildings. They crashed at an angle, which meant that their wings, which is where they store most of their fuel, cut through multiple floors. So they splash fuel and debris across multiple floors of the building, igniting fires.
So even assuming that, for some strange reason, five of those cubic yards were all to end up in the only elevator shaft that goes all the way to the bottom of the tower, there wouldn't be enough to reach the basement in significant quantities. Your typical 10-foot by 30-inch backyard pool contains roughly 1,000 gallons of water, which is the equivalent of 5 cubic yards. Imagine dumping the water from this pool into this kind of elevator shaft with a drop of more than 1,000 feet below, and you'll get the idea of how much fuel can actually reach the bottom. In any case, the fuel in the elevator shafts theory could never account for the powerful explosion that literally devastated the lobby of the North Tower 1 hour after the first impact and before the collapse of the South Tower.
It was a secondary explosion, probably a device either planted before or on the aircraft that did not explode until an hour later.
Then somebody said that they saw an airliner going to one of those towers. Then, an hour later than that, we had that big explosion from much, much lower. I don't know what on earth caused that.
In fact, these firemen reported three large explosions in Tower 1, which took place after the plane's impact. They also confirmed it was the third explosion to devastate the lobby of the tower.
It was an explosion. It was in the lobby, and the third explosion, the whole lobby collapsed on us.
What you told me is that there was a plane or whatever hit the building, then a secondary explosion.
It was like three explosions after that. We came in after the fire. We came when the fire was going on already. We was in the staging area inside the building, waiting to go upstairs. And they exploded. The whole lobby collapsed on the lobby inside.
It took these witnesses about 1 hour to walk down from the 82nd floor to the lobby of the North Tower after the impact of the plane.
We got to the first floor from the 82nd floor.
We stuck on the stairs for a while. We finally got down to the lobby. Then we get to the lobby, it was this big explosion. I don't know if
everything went
just like what you just seen, that's what we went through before we came out of the building. Then when we get out the building, there's another smoke cloud. Okay.
A similar story here. The long descent from Tower 1 and the big explosion in the lobby.
It was like holy hell coming down them stairs. And then when we finally got to the bottom, we were coming out on a mezzanine level there, and another explosion came right on me, just everyone flying.
Yet another similar story.
Big boom, come down the steps, everything fine till we got to the basement, and everything just fell in. I got trapped on there where another guy crawled out, kept getting hit in the head, bags all around, finally clawed our way out over the rubble.
The situation in the lobby was such that there was no doubt on what had happened.
The ladies that are with me were in the World Trade Center in the first building and escaped through the lobby, where they report they believe there was a bomb in the lobby.
Michelle Scott, office worker.
We ran down the steps to the lobby. There was no lobby. Everything was torn up.
We came outside the lobby. There was no lobby. The lobby was totally gone.
Did you see other people?
People. There was a woman with her face blown off.
Big glass lobby, and all the glass was broken. Wires hanging from the ceiling, the signs that would hang above telling you where to go were all hanging. It was unbelievably scary to look at.
Firefighter John Schroeder was climbing the stairs of Tower 1 when he heard the huge explosion from below.
We were heading up to the 24th floor of the stairwell, and all of a sudden our building got rocked. We got bounced around in the stairwell like pinballs, man. And we just said, you know what? Time to go. We came down, it looked like a bomb went off in the lobby. Everything was exploded, everything was gone. We're like, what is going on here? For every window in the lobby to be exploded, I mean, them windows were like as thick as forget it. They were 2-3-inch glasses, you know, come on. They exploded out of the lobby, you know, it wasn't from the jet fuel. No way.
Then we have the accounts from those who heard explosions moments before the South Tower collapsed. John McLaughlin was a police officer for the Port Authority.
Going into Tower 1, we heard a loud explosion coming from the area of Building 2, and at that point, Building 2 was collapsing.
We saw the top